Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome. California's prisons and county jails are in the news these days, with the state's budget crisis, local funding woes, and concern over prisoner health care. Assembly Bill 109 aims to transfer thousands of inmates from the state's prisons to county jails. That has local officials worried about capacity and funding. Meanwhile, some counties like Fresno have experienced budget cuts that have resulted in entire floors of the jail being closed, and prisoners that would otherwise be held are being released. On top of those issues, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month that California must reduce its prison population by 33,000 inmates by 2013 to ease overcrowding and improve prisoner health care. A federal judge found in 2006 that inadequate health care was resulting in the death of one inmate a week. Later in our program, we'll be joined by Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims and prisoner rights advocate Rebecca Evanson. That's coming up in just a moment. We're joined on the telephone now by Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood. Sheriff Youngblood, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court a few weeks ago had a ruling that's been in the news quite a bit lately.
Yes, they did.
In regards to the mandate for ensuring the health of prisoners in the state's prisons.
Yes.
This is going to have an impact not only on the state prisons, but also on local county jails. How do you see this impacting Kern County?
Well, it's certainly going to have a significant impact on all counties in California. The U.S. Supreme Court has allowed, at this point, 2 years to get to that magic number by CDCR in reduction of state prisoners. Whether that magic number comes from the Supreme Court decision or whether it comes from AB 109 realignment, it can be a mixture of both those, but the magic is getting to that number. So with that said, the significant impact that's going to have on counties is inmates that are sentenced to state prison will now be allowed to spend their time in county jail. In other words, the state won't accept a nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual prisoner. They'll do their time in county jails, theoretically. And what's happening in Kern County, you know, we are under the federal court order where we can only house a certain number of prisoners. We can't violate that number by stacking two, three, four high. When someone comes in currently, my staff spends a great deal of time on looking at who is the least threat to society, to our community, and one comes in, one gets released. Currently, you do about one-third of your time that you're sentenced to in the county jail. So with that said, when state prisoners come in, right now I believe that as sheriff I still have the ability to release those prisoners early as well. To stay within that magic number of my jail population. That is not good news for the citizens of Kern County, because what you're going to have is these people who we know reoffend. The recidivism rate is over 70%. So 7 to 10 of them are going to reoffend. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has essentially done is establish more victims in our communities.
The individuals who would be let out of the facility in the event that this ruling moves forward as you just described, what types of offenses would we be talking about?
That's a great question. And here's the interesting part: non-sexual, non-violent, and what was the third? Non-serious. That's the criteria the state's going to use. What the public has to understand is to get to state prison, you must be an overachiever. You have been through the county system so many times. You've been through rehab. You've been through drug diversion. You've been through all those programs to where when you go to state prison, you either committed something so heinous or you committed something else that's a felony so many times that the court finally gives up on you and sends you to state prison. So these people that are coming out of state prison, will all have a lengthy rap sheet, a lengthy record of preying on our citizens.
Just last week, the County of Kern decided to reject $100 million in state funding for new jail construction. That seems like an odd decision in this time when many jurisdictions are lacking in space. Can you explain a little more why you made that decision?
Yeah, it does seem odd, doesn't it? We were awarded a $100 million grant to build a new almost 900-bed facility in Kern County. The caveat to that was a 35, or actually a 25 with some change, up to $35 million match from the county. I think the public out there in Fresno and Kern County will understand that coming up with that kind of money in today's world and environment is very difficult to do. The governor agreed to go back and change AB 900 to where the $100 million would be a 10% match, as opposed to a 25% match. That requires you to forfeit your award and then recompete with preference points because you've already been awarded it once. So it is a gamble, but it's a gamble that's well worth taking, because I'm not sure that my county, my board of supervisors, would accept the $100 million with the 25% match, where I'm sure they will with a 10% match. So that's the thought process behind it. It's saving taxpayer dollars and county money. And then, of course, sustainable costs come in after the facility's built. You have 90 days to have it staffed and up and running. So that's a totally separate issue.
We're talking with Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood on Quality of Life today. We've been talking about the capacity of the county jails to handle the influx of prison population from the state level, should the current plans to comply with the Supreme Court order to reduce the state's prison population by some 30,000 inmates by 2013 comes to fruition. Give us a better idea of exactly where you're at in Kern County right now in terms of capacity. In Fresno County, there's a situation right now where a lot of the jail is empty, but the jail is still technically at capacity because the county doesn't have the money to provide the staffing and operations for all the floors of the jail. Where are you at in Kern County in terms of available space right now?
We're almost always within our barometer of capacity. We have to keep a flexibility of up to at least 50 vacant beds because of tonight we may book 100 people. And the weekends, it's really critical. So we're at capacity most of the time. We have no empty jail space. We do have a jail that's the state has called the worst jail in that they've ever seen, and that's a minimum facility that literally is falling down. But I'm okay with that as long as they allow us to have inmates in it. It shouldn't be a Taj Mahal. They should not want to come back. But there's a fine line between that and the fact that constitutionally I'm in charge of their welfare while they're in custody, and I certainly don't want to violate that.
Prisoners' rights activists, those concerned with the health of inmates in the state's prisons, hailed the ruling from the Supreme Court just a few days ago.
Yeah, they did.
In regards to the release of prisoners, how do you feel? What do you feel the best way to ensure the health and safety of the state's prison population? What would be your solution? I take it you're not in concurrence with the Supreme Court's decision. Well, what would be your alternative?
Well, you asked what my answer to, or the solution would be. First of all, we have to figure out what the real problem was. Understand that the lawsuit that started this ball rolling would have been about overcrowding in state prisons if that were a constitutional issue, but it's not. Therefore, they didn't sue for overcrowding. They picked an item that is constitutional, and that is lack of health care, and they attack that. And that's what the Supreme Court has looked at. That's what AB 109 is about, the health care of inmates. That's what the bottom line is. Quite frankly, from what I know about the state health care system, first of all, they all have health insurance because they're in custody. I don't think the public can say that. They can go to an emergency room when they have an emergency anytime, and it's paid for. I don't think the public can say that. And so they get health care that I believe, from what I know, is quite adequate. I can tell you in the jails, county jails, they get very good health care. And when a lot of our population has zero health care. So I'm not real compassionate or understanding or have a lot of sympathy for prisoners' lawsuit for lack of health care, because I don't think it exists.
You talked about the recidivism rate earlier in our discussion. What do you see as the best way to reduce that 70% figure? Are there best practices out there that other states are employing, and that California somehow is behind the curve, or is this just the world that we're in right now?
Well, number one, you have to go back. We have to start with our youth, and I mean our very, very young youth. This is going to be a long-term fix. It's not going to be short-term. And we need to work with, we need these Boys and Girls Clubs. We need Sheriff's Activities Leagues. We need all these things to help mentor kids. We need parents to take responsibility for their children. Stop enabling them. Stop defending them every time something happens. And let's get our younger generation on the right track. And you can only do that by investing your time in mentoring those youth. We won't save them all, of course, but we certainly can reduce that 70% number as they grow up. Currently, in Kern, first-time releases from state prison, we had 2,065 of them released last year in 2010, and 1,325 of them reoffended. That's 64%. Now, re-releases, once someone's gone to prison, come back, gone to prison again, that number jumps to 80.5%. So the recidivism rate, there's a certain populace in our prison that we're not going to change. We're not going to make them see the light someday. That's just simply not going to happen. They prey on society, and they prey on our citizens and make them victims. So I'm not talking about that group. I'm talking about our youth and the first-time offenders that we have to get their attention. We have to start with programs when they're very, very young. This is a learned behavior. You know, it's no different than a parent and a grandparent and a great-grandparent that have all been on welfare. The chances are that their great-great-grandchild will be on welfare as well, because it's a learned behavior. And that should be unacceptable to our society.
There's been a good deal of talk about the high cost of the state's prison system, especially compared with other states. There's been some talk about California relying more on out-of-state facilities to house inmates. Do you see that as a viable option?
Well, the first part of your statement is we are more expensive in California than other states in housing prisoners. We're more expensive than private prisons. And, you know, the labor unions have done a great job getting raises for employees and law enforcement. We've done extremely well. Times have changed, and we have to look and accept the fact that time has changed. And the cost of doing business in California is extremely expensive. Understand that in the Central Valley, we're controlled by votes in Northern California and Los Angeles. What we have to say about prisoner rights really didn't have a lot of weight, because the state establishes the minimum jail standards through Title 15 that the sheriff will follow. An example is, I'm told how many calories each inmate will get per day. That might seem absurd, but that's the way it is. So I constantly get, why don't we do what Arizona does? Why can't we put tent cities up? Why can't we do all those things? Well, the truth of the matter is, the state won't allow us to do that, and we're controlled by those northern and Los Angeles voters who tend to vote very liberal. And it's quite frankly, has a very significant impact on us and our state.
We're talking with Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood on Quality of Life today. What are you hearing from your colleagues in other counties throughout the state, not just in the Valley? And certainly you talk with others in similar positions throughout California. What are they saying?
Yeah, you're right. We meet quarterly, and we just met here last week. And some counties are, you know, I feel bad what's happened in Kern, but there are others so much worse. Margaret Mims, she's in a constant battle with her board, which I'm not, and it is really, really easier to get your job done when you're not in a war with the people who control your budget. Now, I understand they see things differently than the sheriff does, but leaving an empty jail is not an answer. That is, when you have beds and people that ought to be in jail, that's not an answer. And, I think boards have to prioritize. But in Stanislaus County, 25% of the Stanislaus Sheriff's Office no longer exists. Sacramento County laid off over 150 deputies. That's pretty devastating. I laid off 40 detention deputies last year in my jail, and I put deputy sheriffs in the jail. But that's 40 real people that had real families that lost their jobs. And so we got hit pretty hard, but there are other counties that are much worse than we are. And, if you go to Mendocino County, quite frankly, their economy is based on medical marijuana, which is kind of off the topic, but it's the biggest farce that we've seen in California. And the taxpayers were, I think, scammed. But that their economy is based on medical marijuana. So every county is uniquely different, and the impacts are all different for each county.
There have been, over the past 10 years, really, continuing discussion about changing California's sentencing rules, and specifically reexamining three strikes. There's renewed talk about that right now. Is this something that you think is wise to revisit, or is it proving its mettle in terms of dealing with the state's criminal population?
That's a great question. There's no yes or no answer to that. What I will tell you is three strikes, as was intended, and as I see it, is one of the best laws we've ever passed. The problem with three strikes is we've kind of gone astray where we have someone for two violent felonies, and the third time they steal a candy bar, and it's more than they've had petty theft before, so it becomes a felony, and we utilize that as the third strike. I think that's what will get three strikes taken away from us. I think it was designed for three violent felonies. There are some felonies, for example, sexual abuse and murder of a child or sexual abuse of a young child. That should be one strike, you're out. We shouldn't give someone that opportunity to do that again, because pedophiles don't change. We know they're going to reoffend. So that should be one strike, you're out. So I'm pretty conservative in that vein, but I want all three strikes to be what they were intended to be.
Sheriff Donnie Youngblood, our guest on Quality of Life today. Sheriff Youngblood, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're talking about the state's prisons and county jails on Valley Public Radio today, and we're joined on the telephone now by Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. Sheriff Mims, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Joe.
We've been talking with Sheriff Youngblood from Kern County about the challenges that they face. Tell us a little more about the challenges that you face in Fresno County in terms of this new law, AB 109. What exactly does this mean in general and specifically for Fresno County?
Well, it's pretty consistent across the state. The plan is that lower-level offenders will not be going to prison. There's a misconception that there is going to be a mass release from state prisons to county jails. But AB 109 deals with prospective sentenced inmates. So that means that rather than being sentenced and going to a state prison, they will be sentenced and stay in the county system. Now, the issue that the State Sheriff's Association has been working on with the governor's office, with the Department of Finance, is if this happens, what are the financial implications? And if it becomes a county program, what increased appropriations will be coming from the state to the counties? And I can tell you that's the major sticking point, where if the program moves from the state to the counties, the full funding must come along with it.
Is this tied up in the overall state budget battle right now? Is that why the funding hasn't been appropriated thus far?
Yes, it is absolutely tied up in the state budget. That when the governor signed AB 109, he also signed a very strong letter that said these programs, even though it passed the legislature, this program will not take effect unless appropriate funding is sent to the county. Now, I get a little nervous when I hear the term appropriate funding, I have to tell you, because it matters appropriate to who, the state or to the direct service providers, which the counties will become.
Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims is our guest on Quality of Life today. Sheriff Mims, you're facing funding issues on a number of fronts right now, and in the news this week, the efforts to cut your budget, there's a threat that nearly 65 deputies may lose their jobs. Can you bring us up to date on the latest from your perspective on the budget that you face?
Yes, I presented my budget issues yesterday morning to the board. I was the first to go in the county system, and I overviewed in the past years what we've had to absorb as far as cuts and layoff. And it's pretty well known that I've already laid off correctional officers that resulted in the closure of jail floors. We've laid off professional staff, community service officers, office assistants, clerical. And over the years, by doing this, I've been able to avoid laying off sworn peace officers, which the deputies are. When we started this year, just starting, $10 million of reduction was taken from the sheriff's office, and $17 million increase in expenditures were charged. So we started off $27 million short from where we were last year. Now, it's mind-boggling to even think about having to make those kinds of cuts, but we worked very hard, and we've got it down to just over $8 million. And that's the part where you can only cut so much before you really have to start laying off people. 86% of my budget, 86% is salaries, and that doesn't leave a lot of room to cut anywhere else.
I asked Sheriff Youngblood this. What are you hearing from your colleagues in other counties? How are they dealing with some of these issues, and what are the collective concerns?
Well, the same things are happening. In fact, I just read an article this morning. Santa Barbara County is closing a jail facility that they have. Across the state, many sheriffs are having to close jail facilities, and also police chiefs. I read every day where cities are laying off their police officers. So this is across the board in the state of California. Now, in Fresno County, we do have a reduction in crime rates. You know, we independently keep our crime rates. The unincorporated Fresno County area may have different statistics than the 15 cities, for instance, that are in Fresno County. But we have had, over the past several years, decrease in violent crimes and property crimes. So that's good news. However, we still need the contingent of deputy sheriffs out there answering calls for service. And let me give you an example, Joe. Today, right now, as I sit on this Tuesday morning at 9:20 in the morning, in the 6,000 square miles of Fresno County, there are probably about 20 deputy sheriffs out there answering calls for service. And it is a huge, huge area to cover with already very short staffing. And I try to drive that point home to the board members that just imagine being a deputy sheriff and your backup being 15 or 20 minutes away.
Sheriff Margaret Mims joins us on the telephone today. From Fresno County, we're talking about the state's prison population, the impact on the local county jails, and the new legislation that has recently been passed, is yet to be funded, that aims to shift a lot of the state responsibilities and former inmates in the state prisons to county jails. Sheriff Mims, in the news last month, there was an issue in regards to federal inmates in the county jails and some issues about compensation and how much money is transferred in prisoners and things like that. Can you bring us up to date on the latest on that issue in Fresno County?
Sure. Many counties have contracts with the federal marshals. And because Fresno County is the home court, the place where the federal courthouse is located in the Central Valley, we have about, we were up to over 400 inmates at one time, and we're down to just over 200 right now. And what happened were the federal marshals realized they had, it was described to me as all their eggs in one basket, which means should something happen, they didn't have a contract with other facilities in the Central Valley to be able to house federal inmates. And so they needed a backup plan, which means they contracted or are contracting with Kern County so that they have options. And that's completely understandable. I think that makes sense. Of course, the impact to the Fresno County Sheriff's Office is a reduction in revenue as those inmates are shifted to another facility. I've met with a marshal last Friday up in Sacramento and just passed on the message that, you know, we've got empty jail floors, and if he ever wants to increase the number of inmates in Fresno County, he's more than welcome to do so, especially if we can open a new floor. That would be the best-case scenario.
You mentioned the empty jail floors. About what percentage of the jail is empty at this point due to the staffing reductions?
A little less than half. We have about, our capacity right now is 1,923 beds. If we open up the jail floors that are currently closed, that's an additional, just over 1,200 beds. So we have 1,200 empty, about over 1,900 that we have capacity for right now. So a little less than half is closed.
Assuming the funding for AB 109, which again is the measure to shift the responsibility for those state inmates to county jails, assuming the funding comes through, will that change? Will those floors be reopened or portions thereof?
If that funding comes through, and that's the real big if, and I'm hoping that that happens. If I truly believe we can do a better job, less expensive job here locally. And that is the premise that we all start from. And for instance, we have options. The state is saying, we will send you a certain amount of money. We just don't know what that is yet. And counties, you decide what you're going to do with this sentenced inmates. You can choose to put them on probation. You can choose to put them on electronic monitoring. You can choose to put them in a reentry facility. You use the money however you see fit. Now, I just have to imagine that some of those inmates are going to have to be incarcerated. And if the money does come with that and we can open up a jail floor, we might have additional room for our local arrestees.
Sheriff Margaret Mims has joined us on the telephone today talking about the jail population and the issues involving state prisons. Sheriff Mims, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe. It was a pleasure.
This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with Rebecca Evanson, a staff attorney with the Prison Law Office, a prisoner rights advocate. We'll hear from her and also take your calls. Let us know what you think about the state's prison system and the county jails. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Back in a flash. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We're talking about California's prison system on our program today. You can call us with your comments. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. We're joined on the telephone now by Rebecca Evanson, a staff attorney with the Prison Law Office. Rebecca, welcome to our program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little more about the history of the case that wound up before the Supreme Court last month, where the a majority of justices sided with the folks in the prison rights advocate community and mandated that California release 33,000 inmates to help improve the health care system for inmates. Where does this? What are the origins of the lawsuit?
Well, this case arises out of two separate actions that were filed about inadequate medical care and inadequate mental health care in the prisons. In both cases, the level of care is so bad that the Supreme Court and the District Court both found that it amounts to cruel and unusual punishment to detain prisoners in conditions that are so bad. So, for example, the medical care is so bad in our prisons and remains so bad that a prisoner dies every week as a result of inadequate medical care. These are deaths that would not occur if it weren't for the terrible medical care they're receiving. And on the mental health side, our suicide rate in our prisons is twice the national average. The care is simply dismal. There's never been any dispute about that. The state has long conceded that the medical care remains unconstitutional. It's that bad. But the state has proposed other remedies for it. But what the court found and what the Supreme Court found is that there is no doubt that the level of crowding in our prisons has made it impossible to fix the medical and mental health care systems. We have twice as many people in the prisons as the prisons were built to hold. And so that doesn't just mean double selling and filling all the gyms and rehab rooms with beds. It also means we just don't have enough medical facilities. The medical care and mental health care infrastructure is simply overwhelmed by the number of prisoners who are there.
Now, the state has made improvements, or at least what the state would characterize as improvements. I'll leave that up to individuals' judgments. But the state has, with the help of the receiver, which I believe was appointed by the federal government, Clark Kelso, made improvements in health care. It's not enough. Is that what your organization's view is? There's still too far to go?
That's right. There have been steps forward, and we're very happy about that. But the receiver himself has said he's simply going to be unable to cure these deficiencies in the delivery of medical care with crowding at its current levels because, as I said, and as the receiver has said, the medical care infrastructure is overwhelmed by the number of prisoners who are housed in our prisons.
Can you give us some examples of the types of inadequate care that you're talking about? That's a rather generic term. Specifics, what are some examples?
Well, you know, some of the more stark examples that we heard about at trial, we heard from a former warden at San Quentin Prison about how a prisoner was housed in a gym that was not meant to be housing. It was meant to be a place where people could recreate and also get rehabilitated. But it's now filled with triple bunk beds, you know, 200 or 300 prisoners with two guards in the unit. And in this gym, a prisoner was stabbed in the middle of this crowded unit, and there was no emergency response. The guards didn't even know about the stabbing until hours after the prisoner had died. That's just one example of how it's impossible to provide medical care in these crowded gyms. Other examples abound. Prisoners having heart attacks, clutching their hearts, falling to the floor, fainting, screaming for help. There's nobody there to help them. They don't get to emergency care. They die. Prisoners with severe cancer who are seen time and time again by nurses or primary care doctors who say, there's a problem here. We need to get this guy specialist care. He dies of testicular cancer before he ever sees a doctor who could treat his cancer. So those are the kinds of inadequacies that we see. In the mental health care realm, there are so few providers that people who are in severe mental health crisis wait months and sometimes years for care. And sometimes the conditions in which they're waiting are beyond deplorable. The Department of Corrections uses these stand-up cages, which are about the size of a phone booth, where you can't even sit down, where there's no toilet. And they house prisoners in these stand-up cages for months, for hours or days, while they're awaiting mental health crisis beds. So these are the kinds of things that are contributing to our extraordinarily high death rates and suicide rates in our prisons.
The Supreme Court, in order to rectify this situation, mandates the reduction in the prison population of around 30,000 inmates, in fact, a little over 30,000 inmates in 2 years. Is this a problem that can be solved simply by reductions in capacity in the prison population, or is this something that is still, in your view, inadequate?
The reduction in prison crowding is going to enable the receiver and the state officials who run health, mental health care to remedy these intolerable conditions. With the current level of crowding, all of the involved parties have said, we can't do it. And so once crowding is reduced, I think all or almost all of the conditions are going to be in place to allow these problems to get fixed. And, you know, another thing that the court said, and that's backed up by all of the evidence from the states, from the counties, from the sheriffs, and from the DAs, is that our prison system and our mass incarceration system is not working for public safety, that our high recidivism rate is also caused by the level of crowding that we have in the prisons, and that we are putting in prison individuals who, if they lived in any other state, would never go to prison, and whose outcomes, that means their likelihood of reoffending, is worse because they're in prison. So there are safe and effective means for reducing prison crowding, been used in other states, Texas, New York, Illinois, that have had that have enabled the states to get a handle on crowded prisons, to reduce prison crowding, and also to improve public safety outcomes.
We're talking with Rebecca Evanson, staff attorney with the Prison Law Office, today on Quality of Life. Let's go to the phones now and talk to Monica in Fresno. Monica, you're on Quality of Life. I understand you're calling from the Fresno County Jail.
I'm not calling from the Fresno County Jail, but I've been incarcerated before, and I've been there. And I'm not trying to incriminate anybody on the radio. I can't believe I'm in my life, but like that what she just said about like the percentage of the jail is empty. I mean, I think is like cool, because I just maybe 3 weeks ago just. I went for fighting with my boyfriend in public or whatever, and of course we got let go or whatever. And we spent 5 days, I believe. Yeah, 5 days incarcerated, but they let us go. Anyways, I go, and there's only one floor that's open in the whole, and it's the smallest floor inside the jail. It's not, it's the smallest floor, and it's the only floor that's open, and the rest of the jail is empty. Like they're not. And matter of fact, the whole so I don't understand like the reason. I don't know. It really blows my mind about the whole what's going on, how they're just letting people go.
Well,
and
thank
I think
you.
That they're coming up with all these reasons, and that's not the reason why that's happening. I believe that they know more than what they're saying they know, and I just think whatever reasons they're giving
great.
On the radio right now are bullcrap. Like, seriously, that's what I think.
This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Let's go to line number 3, and John, you're on Quality of Life.
Good morning. I'm Dr. John Cutler. I'm a psychologist in prison.
Yes.
I work in the crisis beds. I would like to clarify some of the statements that the previous caller made about the conditions of inmates awaiting mental health treatment services in the crisis beds.
Yes, go ahead.
It is true that telephone-sized metal booths are used as holding cells. However, number one, they do have seats in them, which work for all except the very tallest of the patients. Those are holding cells which are used only to get them as far as the emergency room, and they are typically there within a couple of hours. The crisis bed is a 25-unit facility, which is part of a larger acute care hospital. The fact is, mental health needs supersede medical needs, and if it is necessary, medical patients are moved out into the community to make room for as many mental health patients as there are. This costs the state a tremendous amount of money that, in terms of medical care being provided in community hospitals with guards escorting inmates and transporting them, as opposed to treating them at the acute care hospital. But it would be completely wrong to say that mental health patients have to wait for any great period of time, not only in the crisis bed unit, or at any level of care, even for patients who are waiting for an initial screening, that has to be done within 24 hours of a request for mental health services. Situations are deplorable. Don't get that wrong. However, it's not as that previous caller described, and situations are rapidly improving.
Well, John, thank you very much for your call, and we'd also like to thank our guest on this segment, Rebecca Evanson, staff attorney with the Prison Law Office, for joining us on this discussion about California prisons. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. It's been 7 years since Fresno County voters passed Measure Z to help fund the county zoo, or not the county zoo, the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. We'll be joined by Zoo Executive Director Scott Barton and also Barry Falk of Rotary Storyland and Playland to talk about summertime recreational opportunities and the zoo's pending expansion. It's coming up next on Quality of Life. Stay with us.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. Early in the last decade, the future of Fresno's Chaffee Zoo was in doubt. The longtime fixture of Roding Park, owned and operated by the city of Fresno, was in disrepair, in danger of accreditation problems, and lacking a stable funding source. In November 2004, Fresno County voters passed Measure Z, a sales tax increase of 0.1% to fund capital improvements and operations at the Chaffee Zoo, formerly owned and operated by the city. Now, zoo improvements are beginning to get underway. In fact, some are already in place, and a major expansion is on the way. Joining us in our studio, we have Scott Barton, executive director of the Fresno Chaffee Zoo, and also his neighbor in Roding Park, Barry Falk, president and CEO of Rotary Storyland Playland. Did I get your title
right,
Barry?
That's correct. That's correct.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Starting with you, Scott, the Measure Z passed back in 2004. This is something that had a great deal of support in Fresno County. The zoo serves beyond Fresno County, though, and so much of Central California. Many people have been waiting to see the improvements. What's been the delay so far?
Well, we've actually done a lot of improvements, but they have been rather small in comparison to what's ahead. So we brought Stingray Bay in here to the zoo, which has been incredibly successful. Recently, we did a dino dig, which has been great and very, very popular. We've done improvements to the reptile building. We've cleaned up the zoo a lot, done new graphics. So lots going on. But you're right in that the major projects are still ahead. And in fact, we go before City Council for approval of our master plan and expansion this month. So all of this has led up really to June 23rd, 4 o'clock. We go before City Council. And with their approval, we hope to be in construction of the first major exhibit, which is Sea Lion Cove. It's a beautiful exhibit. We hope to be in construction by August. We already have the design done. We've talked to the city about permitting. We're just waiting for the City Council vote.
One of the major sticking points with the zoo expansion has been Roding Park and the environmental impact report. That is what's going before the council at this time. And how are you dealing with the concerns? There's been a lot of controversy with the Roding family who donated the land for the park many, many years ago. They're now out of town, but many of them aren't so keen on expanding the zoo and removing some of the parkland that their family helped create.
That's right. The park is about 147 acres, and with the expansion of the zoo will be about 39 acres. And so it leaves roughly about 100 acres of green open park space, which we think functions very well for our community. But you're exactly right in that the Roding family, which is from the Oakland area in the Bay Area, is in opposition to this project. And in fact, it's interesting that much of the opposition to the Roding Park plan comes from the Bay Area.
We're talking about the expansion of Fresno's Chaffee Zoo, but your neighbor is right just a stone's throw away with Rotary Storyland and Playland. You both share some common traits in that both entities are resources for people in the Valley, especially in today's economy, who people might not be able to take a long vacation somewhere out of town and have these resources right in the Valley. Barry, turning to you, Rotary Storyland Playland going back many years also has had some challenges, but
sure.
some improvements lately. Yeah. Walk us through the timeline of how we got to where we are today from where things were a long time ago, and they weren't so good back then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Rotary Playland was birthed in 1955 and actually opened just about 2 months before Disneyland did, kind of a little fun fact, and certainly has had a long history itself of really giving back to the community as well as having challenges. And one of the significant challenges that happened really in the late 90s, early 2000s, was the state of California implemented a new set of ride regulations for permanent amusement parks, which had never really been done before in the state of California. And at that time, it was a really kind of turning point for our park in the sense to where there were a lot of rides, frankly, that were out of compliance. And the park almost shut down completely for about 18 months. And it was a very challenging time, much like when any organization goes away for a while and you really are having to rebuild public trust and rebuild people's perception of what this park is really a phase. Really, I would say the dark years of Storyland and Playland were the early 2000s, where we had to really re-identify ourselves and figure out what we were and really regain that public trust. Well, since 2006, certainly we are proud to say that we've completed well over $1 million of new improvements, capital improvements to the parks. We are operating in the black for the first time in a very long time. And I think that a new focus on guest service particularly has made all of the difference for us. And we are very serious, as I know Scott is, about the guest experience at either the Chaffee Zoo or Storyland and Playland. And we're trying to create an experience where families can come and with their children and where grandparents come with their grandchildren, have a terrific experience at either the Chaffee Zoo or Storyland and Playland. I think what they're going to find, particularly if they haven't been there in a long time, is they're going to be very surprised at what they see at both of those attractions. These are truly Central California jewels of the area, and that you will find parks that are very clean. You will find new amenities at both the Chaffee Zoo and at Storyland and Playland, and something that we feel is a very viable destination for children and families of the valley, frankly.
Turning back to Scott Barton from the Fresno Chaffee Zoo, there are a number of animal rights activists who have been increasingly vocal about their opposition to zoos and the confinement of animals. Some of those activists were in Fresno this weekend protesting at the zoo. Can you characterize your organization's position on the humane treatment of animals? There were some signs that were rather disturbing and photos that were rather disturbing at this protest. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, the photos weren't from Fresno Chaffee Zoo. And I think, you know, some of the comments that I made about that was there are elephants in situations where we need to improve their care, but that's not at Fresno Chaffee Zoo. Our elephants are extremely well cared for. And anyone that's, you know, to our staff and to the media, I've really talked a lot about us focusing on three things, and that's excellent animal care, an excellent guest experience, and an excellent experience for our staff. And so we have been focused very much on providing excellent animal care. And I got to tell you, we have one of the best animal care staffs in the country. They're just excellent. And so for that particular reason, I think the protests were a little bit misplaced. We had 5 people show up to protest. We had 3,000 people visit the zoo that day.
We're talking about the Fresno Chaffee Zoo and Rotary Storyland Playland. And, you know, it's summertime. People are looking for vacation opportunities and to have the kids and get out of the house and do something fun and educational. So we'd like to know what you think, if you've been to the zoo lately and maybe have some thoughts or ideas on its future. Maybe you were a voter that supported Measure Z back in 2004. You can call us right now at 559-275-8989. Or toll-free 800-224-8989. We're talking about the zoo, and this station reaches beyond Fresno. Your zoo as well pulls people from throughout California. Tell us about your audience, the folks who attend the zoo.
Absolutely. So we certainly primarily serve the Fresno community. However, we got some really interesting data in 2010 where of 58 counties in California, 55 were represented in visits to the Fresno Chaffee Zoo, which was surprising to me, actually. And then we looked beyond that. 45 states around the country were represented in visits to our zoo, including Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., and American Samoa. But then if you go outside the United States, 20 countries outside the U.S. were represented in visits to Fresno Chaffee Zoo in 2010. So while we definitely serve our community well, we're also reaching out far beyond the international borders. We had people from Sweden, France, Germany, Japan, Australia all visit the zoo in 2010.
Let's turn back to Measure Z now. You mentioned some of the expansion that's gone on so far, new attractions, new exhibits, new animals, Stingray Bay, things like that. But most of the big ticket items are in this next phase that's due to be approved later this month by the city council. In terms of money, how much are we looking at for this expansion, and how much is in the pot right now in the sales tax proceeds that have been raised since 2005 or whenever this took effect?
Well, one of the exciting things, I think, for Playland, Storyland, as well as the zoo, is these are really success stories for the Valley. And you know, we kind of are self-deprecating and sometimes focus on the negatives. Both our institutions are in the black. We're doing well. Attendance is doing great. In 2010, we had the highest attendance since 1991, and this year is tracking 8% ahead of that. So people are responding. They're coming. The money has been very well cared for. So right now, for capital projects, we have $41 million in the bank, and that's managed through the Zoo Authority Tax Board, who oversees that funding. So $41 million ready to start building projects. And one economic study that we saw said beyond serving the community, providing this great zoo, that will provide almost 1,000 construction jobs in the Valley, which is another huge benefit to the program. So $41 million in capital. We've also underspent our operation fund. So we have over $3 million in that fund. Plus, we've been able to build up a foundation and investments of over $7 million. So the board has been a great steward of the money, and the zoo is primed for long-term financial success.
It's probably important, I think, to mention just a distinction between the Chaffee Zoo and Storyland Playland.
That's going to get there.
and that is the fact that Storyland and Playland are a completely separate organization than the Chaffee Zoo, and that Measure Z monies don't go towards our improvements. And so as we also are thinking through capital improvement plans and the future that Storyland Playland has in store, which includes an additional 3.5 acres of expansion area also, and probably dozens of millions of new dollars of improvement over the next 30 years. We are going to be doing that a different approach and really trying to take things project at a time, identifying donors, potential donors that match hand in hand with potential projects. And we're also very much looking forward to that.
Are you also covered under the approval the zoo is seeking with its environmental document going before the city council this month?
That's correct. Yeah, we are all kind of together in this, and it has been a lengthy process, but we are certainly very excited about the fact that we've finally hopefully arrived in this place. And the Roding Park is really being considered as a whole in this, and I think it's been a really journey, certainly between the Chaffee Zoo, ourselves, and the city of Fresno in this, but we're very excited that this date has come.
Scott, one of the concerns with Measure Z has been when it comes time to renew Measure Z. This is coming in 2014, correct?
That's exactly right, November of 2014.
There was a great grassroots campaign done back in 2004 with the signs that were around town, the shape of the elephant, support Measure Z, support our zoo. There was the letter writing campaign in the B, started by a young school child who was a very passionate advocate for the zoo. Is there some concern that that momentum has been lost or could be lost if the improvements that people expected to see back when they voted in 2004 aren't realized come 2014?
I think so. I think we have to prove to the community that we are not only managing the money well, which I think we can prove, but that we're using it in the ways that they want. And so that's why we really do want to move forward with these projects and exhibits and create one of the great zoos in the country. That's what this community supported. That's what they funded. And that's what we want to deliver. So I think those things are really important. Just as a note, there was so much incredible community support for Measure Z in 2004, and including Angel Ariano is the young woman who wrote
the
letter. And Angel actually works at the zoo now.
Really?
So that's a really fun aspect of it. But there's an enormous amount of support from the community. Over 73% of the community voted for it, which is just outstanding. And we want to deliver what they want. And we're seeing the result from that, the increased attendance we're seeing. We're getting great feedback from people who are just visiting the zoo maybe for the first time in many years about the changes, about the improvements, about the cleanliness, about the exhibits. And so we're hearing great things, but truly, and I think people think I'm exaggerating, with the Measure Z resources, we can deliver a zoo that's going to become one of the great zoos in the country.
Is that dependent on future Measure Z?
Well,
income?
A future Measure Z certainly would allow us to truly finish off the project. But just what we'll be able to do with this Measure Z will take us a very far in that direction. The a couple groups, the Authority Tax Board as well as the Zoo Board, has asked me to put together a financial plan if it doesn't pass. And so we've recently put that together, which pretty much confirms long-term financial sustainability for the zoo through 2020, 2022. But that said, we certainly do hope it passes again so we can continue the momentum and really create one of the great zoos.
We're talking about Fresno's Chaffee Zoo on our program today. Scott Barton, Executive Director, joins us. Also, Barry Falk of Rotary Storyland Playland. Barry, what's in store moving forward? You talked about some of your expansion plans.
Yeah, we are really excited. One of the things that we are going to be trying to do, and I have kind of a personal goal of trying to be one of the most high-quality family entertainment amusement parks really in frankly the whole state. And the way that I think we go about doing that is to start to create themed environments. And so one of the things that you will see as we begin to release our plan is that there are some very clearly distinguished themed areas. And so we're talking about some things such as kind of an adventure type area. Certainly we'll keep Storyland because everybody loves Storyland. We are very excited about a possible Native American cultural village themed area. Another area that we are looking at is what we're calling Crazy Acres, which is just kind of a whimsical kind of fun little town that certainly young children would like. So themed areas and themed environments is certainly a big part of the direction that we're going to be headed, because what we know from those who have done it very well, such as Disney, is that really works and that people really truly do love to be in those types of environments. So that's definitely the types of direction that we're going to be headed.
Scott, we have about 60 seconds left. We talked about, in general terms, the zoo expansion. What are some of the specific things that are in the big expansion that's coming up before the council later this month?
So the first project is Sea Lion Cove. It's going to be one of the great sea lion exhibits in the world, literally. And then following up with that, and what we really need the expansion area for is to bring back an African section, including lions, cheetahs, rhinos, a new area for elephants. So we need that space to really bring modern themed zoo exhibits to Fresno.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for joining us. Barry as well. Barry Falk, President and CEO of Rotary Storyland and Playland, and Scott Barton, the Executive Director of the Chaffee Zoo in Fresno. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Quality of Life. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. Thanks for joining us. And remember, Valley Public Radio, we are in our spring membership campaign. You can become a member online at kvpr.org. And when you're there, check out our program page, kvpr.org. This is Valley Public Radio, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield. See you next week.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.